Right, I distributed two sets of notes, one to accompany today's lecture, and the other one, because I gave you the same page twice of the Macaulay Minute last week. So that's now an extract from the Minute of 1835, which Macaulay sets out his plan for Indian education. And the main reason to show it to you was the cultural supremacist assumptions that he displays in talking about why English is so much obviously the best language for Indians to be educated in. So it's worth reading it. As I said, you'll certainly come back to it when you do the South Asian material next term. The second set of readings will be for today, and there's some brief notes to accompany the lecture on Gordimer, but then also some background information on Stephen Biko and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which I'll say a few things about also. Also wanted to just remind you that in week five, definitely, and I'm not quite remember if it's week seven or week eight, we have the text that we'll be looking at, literally looking at for the week will be a film. And so I've arranged screenings. The first film is week five, and it will be Tsotsi, 2004, I think, or 2005 film. And I've arranged a room. I'll send out a mass mail about the room, but if you reserve Wednesday evening of week five, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., I'll bring the drinks and popcorn and the movie. If you just bring yourselves, that would be good. So some people, I suppose, are there any... any large number of people who can't make it on the Wednesday evening. Some people I know can't. But then if you can either find the film yourself or else after the screening, I'm happy to lend you my copy so that you'll be able to look at it yourself. Possibly not, though, in time for the Thursday lecture. So today we're looking at Nadine Gordimer's The House Gun. Her writing... Gordimer's, as you will find it. Is this the first novel that you've read of hers, or have you read other things? Her writing is always formidable, I think. It's always quite difficult, quite hard to read. You never sink into a Gordimer novel. The work is spare, it's stripped down, it's cerebral, if not quite ascetic. She doesn't bear witness. Unlike, say, Toni Morrison, another Nobel Prize winner of roughly the same period, she's not in the least bit a religious writer, I think. And not that Morrison is a deeply religious writer, but there's a religious overtone to Morrison's work, which there isn't in Gordimer's. The truth of her work, as one of her better critics, Andries Oliphant, has put it, this is just a statement from Gordimer about how she... about what she thinks fiction can do. She's often asking herself the question of what does fiction do that history can't do? And so this sense of you can get the background, but if you want to understand the relationship between people and time, you must read a novel. She mentions One Piece. She's particularly interested, as many South African writers have been, with the interest is in the great Russian tradition. Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Turgenev, Chekhov, etc. So the truth of her work, as Oliphant has written, and this statement I think is quite interesting, because he's talking about the way in which she manages to transport us into worlds, as he said, seemingly familiar but always profoundly unconventional, which beckon us to meet the challenges they pose. Her writing is charged with the great and subtle forces of our age. Her texts resonate with what lies beyond. And it's interesting that J.M. Coetzee, writing about Gordimer, Coetzee being the other Nobel Prize winner from South Africa, describes her and refers to Anna Akhmatova, the great early 20th century Russian poet, and says that she's a visitor from the future. So that sense of Gordimer, with Gordimer, a lot of time, I think, is spent in the criticism focusing on her relationship to history and her narration of history in some ways. And so the sense of this as Gordimer's work as a chronicle of South African society from her first works begin to appear just after the beginning of apartheid in South Africa 1948 is when apartheid is introduced. Gordimer's first work is from that period, roughly the early 1950s. Her fiction is realist, always, and deeply concerned then with history. Another one of her better critics, Stephen Klingman, has written a book called History from the Inside. And I think that goes some way towards what Gordimer is describing. Here's an interview with her talking about her work. This is from 1990, so it's just before the publication of this book, and it's just before the end of apartheid. Oh no. Sorry, there will be no interview. I don't know how to get the sound on this thing to work. It doesn't seem to make any difference if you turn the sound on. So anyway, that's the... but here, she's answering the questions here about how she comes to write the way she does. And she says that she borrows this idea of you put your hand deep into the matter of your society and what comes up is a kind of relationship between you and the society you live in. No matter how adversarial or difficult that is, you write out of that. That's her, what she aims to do. This is John Cook, who says that it's often claimed that Gordimer only writes one novel in her life. Of course, it's not true. She writes many, and they're very different. But it's often said that they tend to be on a similar kind of topic. And the private life accreting public overtones, the public situation inhabiting private conditions. In that interview, she says that she always begins with people. She starts with the people and moves to place them in context. She says that she herself, although her work begins to take on profound political implications from the 50s onwards, so that she becomes defined as one of the chief anti-apartheid writers and somebody who has a great deal to say about politics in South Africa. She says that her own introduction to politics was slow and belated. She was from a fairly poor white background. She was sent off to read in the library of her small town. And it kind of dawns on her gradually as an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old that in this library there are only white people, white children. The same thing, of course, at her school. When she gets to university, again, the same, only white students, and except for at the postgraduate level, a couple of black students who, in the so-called designated black universities, there was no provision for them to do their PhDs. There was nobody who was specialist, so they were able to come on sufferance, as it were, to the whites-only university. And it was through these people that Gordimer began to meet a community of writers. And through her involvement with writers, she began to have a political awareness, which then became very developed. Not only in that her own work was banned on a number of occasions, three of her novels were banned after publication, but also through her work with Pen International and through her general political work, she became a very prominent activist and spokesperson against apartheid. She wrote this in 1994 on the cusp of just with apartheid ending, so this is the time of this novel, and I think it's very interesting because it talks about her sense that the way she experienced 1994 and the end of apartheid was of South Africa's rejoining of the world, and also of the sense in which her own relatively embattled position as a white writer against apartheid. So in that sense, a minoritarian figure within the white community, connected by solidarity to the wider South African population, but that connection, of course, fraught with difficulties because of racism. So she says, I'm a small matter, but for myself there's something immediate. The other world, that is, the world outside, is no longer the world. My country is the world, whole, a synthesis. I'm no longer a colonial. I may now speak of my people. So the sense of South Africa coming into its own, the idea of South Africans as late as 1994 for the first time going to the polls and voting their own government into power. And for Gordimer, this is a period of this is a moment of tremendous symbolic significance. She throughout the 1970s and 80s, and particularly after the Soweto uprising of 1976, the government's declaration of a state of emergency, which was never lifted, the intensification of violence and of struggle during the 1980s, Gordimer began to use this idea of the interregnum. It was clear that the world of South Africa in apartheid could not be sustained. It was predicated on too much violence, too much instability. Everything was collapsing in a sense, held down by brute force at some. And it was clear, and yet the new had not yet been born. So that it was as though there was a kind of peculiar waiting. There was an American anthropologist called Vincent Crapanzano who wrote a book called Waiting, which was on the whites of South Africa. But of course, it wasn't only the whites who were waiting. The whole population was waiting. They had different expectations, very obviously. You may say dread on the one side, hope on the other. But here, Gordimer is using this term interregnum from the Italian Marxist activist, theorist, died in prison in one of Mussolini's prisons in the 1930s. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. And you could argue that Gordimer is the diagnostician of those morbid symptoms. Her work anatomizes them and defines them. In The House Gun, the question arises, obviously, of the status of the post in post-apartheid. Once apartheid ends, what does after-apartheid mean? What's the legacy of the years from 1948 to 1994? How can the new dispensation be normalized? What does working through the past there mean? What's involved in living after a dictatorship? And Nelson Mandela's government set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission when it came to power. I'll say more about that later. What content can we give to reconciliation? And is reconciliation the way forward here? That if you think of the way in which other countries which have had brutal military dictatorships have dealt with these problems. So Ecuador, Brazil, there are many of them, the Congo, et cetera, very often Yugoslavia also. This very often the question is of how you go forward once the dictatorship is ended. What do you do about uniting the society which has been driven apart? How do you grapple with the problems of justice in this period? What do you do, for instance, with the people who may have been guilty of crimes against humanity, of torturing other people to death, the people who manned or the police state, the bureaucrats of apartheid? How does one grapple with these people? In some ways, these problems, of course, are familiar to us all after the Second World War, where the Germans instituted a policy of denazification. But what's involved in working through the past? How do you come to terms with these questions? And in South Africa, it's not the only place in which this happened, but Bishop Desmond Tutu, he was the Archbishop at that point of Cape Town, and you know, for reasons which were as much religious as anything else, he argued that that in some sense a healing process ought to take place, a process of reconciliation. The way it would work was that people who had been wronged would be invited to come forward, and those who had wronged them would then be approached and then would be able to, if they confessed their crime and demonstrated that they were sorry for it, they were absolved. If they weren't, they could be prosecuted under the law, obviously, with murder or something like this. And the result was, it was rather an extraordinary process, which I'll talk a little bit more about again later, but where very often you found people confronting their torturers across a room in a court of law, and even more extraordinary, sometimes forgiving them, which was quite devastating to watch. Many, many times there were kind of tears all around, including on the part of the judges. Tutu himself very often photographed in tears at these moments, and quite often, obviously, an attempt to cynically abuse this process by some of the former murderers who were trying just to get off scot-free. And again, I'll talk about this in the Biko case in a moment. What content do you give then to reconciliation? Is that the right way to go? Is it better to reconcile, or would a trial have been better? And imprisonment. Of course, we know what has happened historically with that, the difficulty of, say, in Chile, after Pinochet's dictatorship, where the generals and the architects of the violence couldn't be brought to law, and when they could, they couldn't be prosecuted. So there was never any reckoning, never any kind of grappling with the wrongs that they had done. So sometimes, obviously, reconciliation sounds like a rationalization for those who have committed crime. Sometimes it's as though it's insult on top of the injury that they already did, where the people who have been wronged feel that they now have been brought forward to make a protest, and then nothing happens, and they feel devastated in that process. In the House, Gangordama takes the South African furore over violence and crime since 1984, and she displaces it. This is the point that Alex O'Brien makes in his article on the novel. After 1984, there is this explosion of violence across the country. I'll say more about this, but it's something that everybody becomes consumed with, and it's in this context that Gordimer's book is written. Instead of crimes by the black and poor, in the foreground of the plot, there's a bourgeois murder in which a young white architect kills one of his friends with a gun. Not a political killing. It's a crime of passion. So in a sense, it's the most ordinary and the most routine of things at one level. It brings white identifying readers. That's the phrase that O'Brien focuses on. It's a very interesting phrase because, in some sense, he's going to argue that this book is an exercise in white conscientization, in paying back the wages of whiteness. So in some ways, you could argue that this is another way of approaching the problem of the violence that has happened. Calling people to account, in some sense, exposing what has happened, turning the suburban outrage over violent crime back on itself without invoking a politically overt image of white gunplay. So that point that this is an exercise in white conscientization, in raising the consciousness of whites in the context of the end of apartheid. The action within the novel is situated within a climate of violence. We see this quite early on with a description of Claudia's work. Few of her patients connected her with one of the cases of violence they might have read about. There were so many in a region of the country where the political ambition of a leader had led to killings that had become vendettas fomented by him. A daily tally of deaths was routine as a weather report. Elsewhere, taxi drivers shot one another in rivalry over who would choose to ride with them. quarrels in discotheques were settled by the final curse word of guns. State violence under the old past regime had habituated its victims to it. People had forgotten there was any other way. That's quite early, 49-50 in the novel. So the sense in which that all around there is this climate of violence, very often for the white population of South Africa displaced elsewhere. The reference in the first sentence, the region of the country where the political ambition of a leader, this refers to KwaZulu-Natal, in which Gacha Buthelezi, the head of a Zulu ethnicist group called Inkatha, tried to set up, as it were, a sort of a private fiefdom after the end of apartheid, arguing that there should be a separate Zulu land for the KwaZulu, for the AmaZulu people, there was a great deal of sort of young, as a gang-related crime, I guess I would describe it as, which just intensified for a period through the late 90s and so on. The point that Gordimer makes here is that this crime, which is experienced by white South Africans as something new and horrific after apartheid, had, of course, always been the story of apartheid. What is apartheid if not systematized violence in some sense? And she makes this point on a number of occasions. There had been so much cruelty enacted in the name of that state they lived in. So many fatal beatings, mortal interrogations, a dying man driven across 1,000 kilometers naked in a police van, common law criminals singing through the night before the morning of execution, etc. The penalty unknown individuals paid was not in question compared with state crime. So we get this absolute studied emphasis on her part on the fact that during apartheid, apartheid was a criminal regime, that violence was what underpinned it. And here it might be worth saying, looking back for a moment, to say a few things about apartheid violence, about the resistance to it, and then perhaps about a little bit about the one case, perhaps, of Stephen Biko. So the images, apartheid is very obviously just an extension in some ways, an extension, a rationalization, a systematization, an upgrading, if you like, of colonialism. What it does is to formalize colonial rules. And here one of the many orders: anyone disobeying these laws will be imprisoned, fined, and/or whipped. All Africans must display a pass. Africans are stripped of rights to own land. They are stripped of rights to go to universities. Interracial, so-called marriages and alliances are banned. Black people are not allowed to form trade unions. These kinds of laws and policies are fairly standard across the colonial world. You find them in Ghana during British colonial times. You find them in India during British colonial times. You find them in the Sudan. All over the world. It's in South Africa. They are late, in 1948, and they represent a kind of a last-ditch attempt to formalize and to make eternal colonial dominance, white supremacist dominance. Whites who are some 10-12% of the population own 80% of the land, they own 95% of the resources, etc., etc. Black labor is crucial to them, but not black rights. And so as you can imagine, this, in order to impose this policy, a systematized use of the military, the police force, and the states the courts was required. And you see images like this very, very frequently. Apartheid is very frequently photographed. This would have been simply a search of a house in a township somewhere, Soweto maybe, Alexandra, Guguletu, Langa. In which a boy, who could not be accused of being guilty of any crime, he's about 12, runs from the police, and the police are then trying to hit him with batons. If we look, three of them, three adults, almost as a kind of a game of sport. But this kind of casual racist violence meted out every single day across the entire country for 40 years. Sometimes with absolutely more deadly effects in response to rising black resistance. Very often, you know, met with deadly force. This is obviously a color photograph, so presumably from the 70s, the 80s, rather than the 40s or 50s. This is a scene from much earlier. I think this is actually from the Soweto uprising of 76, where school children in Soweto, which is the big township outside of Johannesburg, resolved that they refused to be taught in Afrikaans, which was the language of the white minority, the majority of the white minority population. They wanted to be taught in English, because for them English was a gateway to the world outside. Afrikaans, they felt, would lock them into South Africa. And so they marched in their thousands with protests June the 16th, 1976, saying no to Afrikaans, and were met with this extraordinary violence. And this particular image, which became went the 1976 equivalent of going viral. It's a devastating photograph. One of the first boys shot dead. A friend of his who picks him up and carries him. His sister, who's running with him. Next to that, and the story gets even more tragic in the sense that the police then attempt to find this boy who is carrying the dead child, and he escapes, we know nothing of him. He probably commits suicide somewhere abroad some years later. We don't actually. He doesn't return to South Africa, but probably tried to find his way towards one of the African National Congress military installations or something outside the border, but then seems to wind up at one point in Holland, but then the trail just goes cold. Nobody knows what has happened to him, but the assumption is that he killed himself. So, it's a truly devastating image, but you get the sense also of the rising climate of protest. Protest which ranges from everyday forms of resistance to much bigger organized strikes. Here, from very early 1956, this is from the women's strike. Women played a very active role and often led the movement. So here was a strike in which women returned all of the passes which had been given. They refused to accept the passes, returned all the passes. A massive march on Pretoria. The idea of women marching, of course, raised the question of how to control that crowd. Do you wade into a crowd of women with bayonets, tear gas, and so on? And it takes another step, as it were, something that you could do to young men seemed as though you couldn't go that far with women. But this group of women, you'll notice the multi or the non-racial character of the resistance here. Don't imagine that in South Africa all of the people who protested were black and all of the ones who dominated were white. Many whites, like Gordimer, aligned themselves with the anti-apartheid movement. So this then brings us perhaps to the figure referred to, the figure locked up, spread naked, massively injured in the back of a van for 900 miles. I've given you a description, I think, in the literature, The Death of Stephen Biko. And you see that Biko had been one of the founding figures in the development of black consciousness in South Africa in the late 60s and early 70s. Was apprehended in 77, tortured over several days, basically murdered by the police, and then at the point of death, it was finally decided. Doctors had seen him on all 3 days and said he was fine. Which was also, in other words, the medical establishment was also part of the apartheid machinery. Eventually, they decided they should take him to hospital, but they decide to take him from Port Elizabeth in the Eastern Cape up to Pretoria in the far north, the distance, the 1,000 kilometres that Gordimer. A dying man, stripped naked, beaten over several days, and by the time he reaches Pretoria, he's dead. At which point the Minister of Justice, a man named Jimmy Kruger, announces that Biko's death leaves me cold, he said. But it didn't leave the people in the world cold. And again, so Biko's death became a huge cause célèbre, became one of the bricks, if you like, in the mortar which saw the end of apartheid. It became a huge controversy. It focused international attention on the violence of the South African regime. But you can see that look at the nature of Biko's rhetoric. This is the rhetoric of 1970s. He's obviously drawing very centrally on black consciousness in the U.S. This is the language of the Black Panthers, in a sense. So the 60s, the links between black South Africans and African Americans and of black struggles elsewhere in the world was important. You can beat me or jail me, but I'm not going to be what you want me to be. He published several articles and books in his life, but the posthumous work was called I Write What I Like. And so that sense of just the refusal to mold himself in the image of white South Africa. So this is the reality that is always there, that Gordam is trying to mediate in her book. What marks the difference of the beginning of this novel is we keep getting this phrase, something terrible had happened, is it's through Duncan's act that the outside implodes into the inside. The whole world system, in some way, of the Lingards has been designed to keep this kind of stuff at a distance. Live as though you're actually in Australia, as it were. Live as though nothing is wrong. Focus. Keep all of the news. Don't read the newspapers if necessary. Keep everything outside at a distance. Live in this walled-in community. Literally, as we'll see, walled in. But that sense of inure yourself to the outside. If you think of what Claudia does, she's a doctor. Every day, people come to her with illnesses of some kind. Sometimes these are illnesses of poverty. Sometimes she must have dealt with knife wounds and this kind of thing, but she never she administers to her patients. She's a good doctor, but she never asks them questions about their life. She doesn't want to get involved because she knows that in some sense that will plunge her into a morass from which she spent her whole adult life keeping herself at a distance. You could say in some sense, not her fault, as it were, that she's not one of the architects of apartheid, but she's clearly one of the people who profits from it or whose life is predicated on it, and she never asks those sorts of questions. So with Duncan's act, though, because Duncan, because somebody knocks on their door, and changes their whole world. That's the way in which Gordimer describes the outside flooding into the inside. So that reality becomes their reality also, necessarily. I meant to say something about truth and reconciliation here. Here were the posters. If your mother, it's extraordinary posters, aren't they? If your mother was tortured, father murdered, and children abducted, would you be silent and appeal to people? Imagine seeing that on our streets here. But the sense in which come forward if this is the case, and we will consider your case. And some people, of course, experience this as tremendously empowering, as perhaps it was for a lot. The proceedings were televised. They were watched by millions of people every day. They were extraordinary dramatic incidences. So here is the inside the case. Very great deal of attention paid to the openness of the proceedings. These were not closed door proceedings. Everybody had to know because the whole point was about transparency. So somebody would stand up, would challenge. Imagine what was involved in actually looking your murderer or the person who had, your torturer or the person who had murdered your mother in the eye and saying, you murdered my mother. That was extraordinary, both empowering but also very, very frightening, I should imagine. And then the whole series of witnesses, the way in which these things were played out in front of the court of law, and then often the response from the torturer himself, very often we have to say very often, actually, full of sorrow for what had been done. You know, using the obvious kinds of arguments, you know, I was a sergeant in the army, I was told to beat somebody, I beat them. You know, it wasn't my philosophy. And much of that believable, one should say. But, you know, and then these scenes at the end. Again, so here is one incident where Tutu, hearing the witness, the evidence, breaks down. Lots of these sorts of scenes. And if you look in the literature I've given you, you'll see that Stephen Biko's family, they believe that they should, that his killers should never have been brought up on the truth and reconciliation to the truth. They thought that what they wanted was a trial. They wanted a criminal trial. So they were opposed to the idea of reconciliation. And then particularly because the people who had beaten him to death then attempted to use the TRC hearings as a way of getting off, as it were. Lied under oath, said that they hadn't done what they had done, and eventually they were not given absolution, but they were never tried either, because by the time this had all taken place, the new Minister of Justice in the country post-apartheid decided that too much time had gone by, and that they couldn't find enough. How do you find witnesses to the police's beating up of you? That, by definition, is impossible, and so they had to let the case go. These murderers are still alive and well in South Africa, and it's, you know, that and the rage of the Biko family is testified to in what I have shown you. So, here's Gordimer writing. This is the kind of writing that Gordimer that leads Gordimer to sometimes be accused of being cold towards her characters. I'm not so sure that that's what's involved here. I think that there's some very interesting things that take place in the novel. So they weren't racist, if racist means having revulsion against skin of a different color, believing or wanting to believe that anyone who is not your own color is intellectually and morally inferior. Yet neither had joined movements, protested, marched in open display, spoken out in defense of those convictions. They thought of themselves as simply not that kind of person. Keep yourself free, as many whites did in South African apartheid. Keep yourself clean, free, as though you could, free of what is happening out there. Don't participate, but don't get involved in ending it either. So previously they'd been able to keep these words separate, but here's the moment at which the outside breaks in on the inside, very early. And we'll have to talk about this he-she construction later. He strides off and switches off the television and expels a violent breath. So long as nobody moved, nobody uttered the word, and the act, the word within the word, could not enter here. Now, with the touch of a switch and the gush of a breath, a new calendar is open. The old Gregorian cannot register this day. It doesn't exist in that means of measure. What's being announced here is not just a new day, but a whole new way of measuring time. The Gregorian calendar, which changes from the old Hegelian calendar or whichever other calendar was being used. It's a completely new conceptual schema that they have to get their heads around. Something their old world has shattered, and this new world comes flooding in, and they are simply not equipped to deal with this new world. So now, once this has happened, there's no outside of violence. And she makes this point. There's a labyrinth of violence not counter to the city, but a form of communication within it. Violence, a reading of its varying density, could be taken if a device like that which measures air pollution were to register this daily. It's almost as though if you had a kind of Geiger counter, it would go red on certain days where there's so much violence systematically floating around the society. But what she's doing is thinking of 1994, the end of apartheid, as the moment at which, let me try and use a kind of completely counterintuitive language here, the moment at which the violence which has been there for so long becomes democratized. It's a terrible thought. I mean, how can you democratize violence? But what I mean is that violence Violence no longer is something that happens only within black communities and only to black people. The wages of whiteness involve here, in this novel, a belated kind of awareness that violence is systematically distorting. That's the point that she makes in her own work. Of course, violence is devastating for those on whom it is practiced. It murders people, it kills them, it maims them, it mutilates them. But what is the effect of that violence on the social fabric, on the body of society, on white people themselves? And here, Gordimer uses the language of deformation and derangement and words like that over and over again. So what happens brings the order of the townhouse what it wasn't built to contain. If that's got no sound, I won't play that. But here's a townhouse. A couple of points to note about them. Townhouses are these, as it were, sort of cluster homes that have been built, many of them since the end of apartheid. Well, in fact, most of them now, because most of the housing stock is quite new. This is in an upper middle class neighborhood. So notice the huge gates with electrified barbed wire on the outside, very often a security guard on the outside as well. There are a couple of houses within the compound, five, six, as it were. You can't get in, even if you're a visitor, you can't get in without ringing some bell, be factored in. And this is what happens. They're in the townhouse when the news comes. And so their first thought is to actually just keep it outside. They know it's bad news. Nobody's going to ring them at this hour with anything else, but keep it out. But you can see that this what kind of social world is represented by this kind of housing. This is not what we would understand as a community or a civic space in some way. This is about privatization, about ownership, and about control, as though you can control space, not letting anybody in. Those walls are, I left South Africa just after Soweto in the 1970s. I didn't return for about 20 years, excuse me. When I did, I was shocked because when I had grown up, there were, just like here, there were no fences around houses. People would walk into each other's houses all the time. When I went back, I was confronted by things like this, where 15-foot high fences outside of people's homes. Inside the homes themselves, there are further fortifications. So you go to bed not just by locking the front door and going to bed. You lock the front door with seven different locks. You then move towards the inner part of the house where there's another gate which you close with a lock, hide the key, and then go into your bedroom which you lock. I mean, this is an extraordinary sense of lockdown would be the right thing. I mean, this, there are no South Africans, white or black, more or less, anymore, who walk around without, a huge kind of, 10-pound bundle of keys. It's the most extraordinary thing. Electrified fences, barbed wire, alarm services, independent alarm services. Nobody calls the police. You all have these armed guards, basically, who you call them and they rush in with guns and so on. When I returned quite soon afterwards, I had a car accident on about my third day back. Because I'd been in the States all these years, I did what I thought you did, was you call the police when you had them. So the person that I crashed into me actually kept saying, don't do that. And I said, why I have to, it's my mother's car, I have to. So I called the police and lo and behold, about 2 minutes later, this tank rumbled in, it was kind of like, they call them Saracens in South Africa, kind of armor-plated thing with gun turrets, screamed, and these guys leapt out of the car with automatic rifles and said, what, where's it, where? I just say, it's a car accident. And they said, why have you called us? That's not what the police do. We don't register sort of misdemeanors. Our job is to actually manage these houses in some ways. It was a quick lesson in the new South Africa, which I wasn't too happy to take, of course. But And the truth of this, as Harold understands quite quickly, is that he and his wife belong to the other side of privilege. They have, because of what Duncan has done, they've moved over, moved across. In its way, that status was definitive. This is a long quotation, which this I think is a fundamental point. But here, the central argument I think that Paul was making is that, as she puts it, violence desecrates freedom. It's a lovely phrase, I think, very 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 effective, very moving, and that sense of violence makes freedom unimaginable in some ways. So how do you then come to terms with these things after violence has happened? I think what the novel examines, is what I would call damaged intersubjectivity, which follows from that idea of violence desecrating freedom. If you think of the relations in the novel, those between the parents and the child, for instance, or those between the two parents themselves, there is damage that comes between them in the novel. The damage is not shown to be cataclysmic. It's not shown to be some major falling out. It's not shown to be anything political, anything with a direct reference to apartheid. And yet what we see is a gradual kind of coldness entering into the relationship between Harold and Claudia. I think that formulation, two formulations from Adorno, who others of you will know I love, but I love the simplicity of wrong life cannot be lived rightly. That gets to the heart of it. And it's clear that the Lingards have been living a wrong life. Again, it's not a choice that they take individually. They are positioned as living in a wrong life. But you cannot live this life rightly. Adorno, of course, is talking about Germany in the period just up to and then during the Second World War. His particular, he's writing as a Jew, and the sense of on the edge of extinction, potentially about to be exterminated. And after the war, he asks this question: can we raise the question whether after Auschwitz you can go on living? So it's obvious that you do go on living if you're a Jew, even if you're a German Jew, after Auschwitz. But what does living mean? How do you live? How do you live with that, not only with the guilt of having been spared, as it were, you know about survivor guilt, et cetera, but then the sense of what was it that enabled you to survive? How can you forget the past? Because doesn't forgetting the past require you to be cold to it? And wasn't that coldness just what led to the disaster in the first place? The fact that you don't think of other people, as your, as fellow citizens. You think of them as Jews, or you think of them in the South African context as, you know, as blacks, or in the South African parlance, natives, Bantu, whatever the terms would be. They are not human. The not human is the first gesture that matters. Elsewhere, Adorno says that when he's talking about a hunter and the prey, a deer, it's when the hunter sees the deer's eyes and doesn't care that the killing becomes possible. You can see, you know, many people go and see a deer and find themselves unable to pull the trigger. What's happening is that the sense of this is another life, another presence, another person. I mean, not the deer, obviously, but that sense occurs. And this is not what happens in the case of systematized apartheid. Somehow you manage to deal with the fact that they, and that word they is often used, them, not us, but they are outside, they are fine, leave them alone, you know, nothing to do with me. And this sense of, isn't that the coldness which makes this possible? And doesn't that happen between Claudia and Harold? So in the novel, I think we see, firstly, we see the demonstration of how far apart they've become, how separated they are. And then we see the destruction of all communicative familiarity or intimacy between them, and between them and Duncan. There's one passage, for instance, in which Claudia tries to take Duncan's hand in hers and he recoils. There's another where we see his thoughts and he says, better not claim me, my mother. Why? Because in some ways there is so much hostility there. One terrifying moment where Harold is talking to Claudia and the phrase is, hostility had sucked all communication into its vacuum. If he'd opened his mouth, God knows what would have come out. This sense of between them, the idea that words are used as weapons now in some way, that they can't speak to one another at all. And then even though that is happening, let me jump ahead here. Even though that's happening, we see that intersubjectivity is still operating between them. And here's where I think this he-she construction that she uses is so interesting to play with. Very often, we don't know who's speaking. We get here, he, comma, she, twitch of a smile. Whose? His? Hers? Both of theirs? He got up with the language, directed her, and went to lift the nearest receiver. Who? She half heard him say, half listening to the commentary following the images. Who? It's very difficult to get a sense of who's speaking here. Very often, in fact, in the communications between Harold and Claudia, you would use the word we. They are speaking in some sense. There's a fused subject position, but both of them seem to be implicated. As Stephen Klingman puts it, the place of the narration is outside both characters, yet rather than simply expressing antithesis between them, it seems also to inhabit both of their minds and reverberate between them. It's that reverberation, I mean, his thing is oscillation. Something runs between them, an energy, a vibrancy, which we can connect, I think, to some kind we could call it something as facile as love, perhaps. Something that may have been lost at one point or looks as though it's in danger, but was there and might be there again. The sense of some kind of hope between them here, some kind of building of community based on the two of them, I think. So their world within a world is itself heartless. It's a wrong life. But the seeds are present within that world of a world that isn't that of the dominant order. If you look very closely at narrative focalization, particularly in the openings, these he, she, he, comma, she, he, slash, she, that's where you find these things taking place. Let me stop at that point. There's much more to be said, obviously. I see I prepared a four-hour lecture, but we only have 50 minutes. Thanks. So I'll see you in an hour, or 2 hours, or three.